Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
So apparently, a lot of people think Patrick Clancy is the one who actually took the lives of the children and somehow magically she's been covering for him for 3 years. And I don't know. We're going to talk about it today, and I welcome your thoughts and your comments in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we go through this. Facebook, wherever you're watching, I'm going to watch them. And if you got a comment, if you got something that you think like, this can't be debunked, or here's, throw it in there. Throw it in there, because that's what I want to do. I want to discuss. I want to hear you out, because, you know, stranger things have happened. And in no way, shape, or form am I saying that I think Patrick Clancy has anything to do with this. But I'm trying to understand why this is becoming a thing, why we're even talking about this. But a lot of people are. So hence, we are going to as well and address some of the comments that we've been seeing that you guys have. Some of the look, with anything, There's misinformation that gets out and people think it's fact, and then they start applying it to their theories and going, see, well, your theory doesn't work if your facts aren't based on reality. Lindsay Clancy is on trial at Plymouth Superior Court for the deaths of her three children, and her own attorney told the jury that she killed them. She has said it as well. The fight in that courtroom is over her mind, not her hands. But online, a growing crowd has decided the real killer is actually her husband, Patrick Clancy. He staged it. He framed his wife and walked away to a new life. Robin Drake obviously is with us, as he always is. Welcome back from a few days off.
Yes,
retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. People got smarter since you've been gone.
Probably.
Oh, wait. No, they haven't. It's gotten worse. where does this instinct come from? I mean, Robin, you've been seeing it in the last couple of days online. Why is the internet, before we dive into some of the specific arms and tentacles of this, why do you think this is something that's gaining traction and people are going after Patrick Clancy?
So I think it's pretty simple, actually. If you've been watching the trial, and a lot of these theories, I think, are coming up because of the people watching a trial, she's a compelling figure in the courtroom. I mean, we said it from the very beginning. She's not performative. She's collapsing onto herself with the vast emotion she has of the remorse, the supreme guilt, her lack of even will to live because of the heinous act she's admitted to doing, killing her three kids. And then you see the people standing with her in the courtroom, basically everyone standing with her, except her psychiatrist, who's getting railed by Reddington right now.
Being civilly sued as well, who has a vested interest.
That's
not
a whole separate story. I know we'll talk about.
Yeah,
I've
exactly.
been watching that all morning.
Yes, yes.
So anyway, what happens in the brain, because I thought a lot about this over the weekend too, what happens in the brain, and with all of us, we want there to be a simple explanation. And when you can no longer, because I think most of these people are now placing the blame on Patrick, or originally placing the blame on her, and not taking into really account what a psychosis and a psychotic break can actually look like long term, mm-hmm. short term. And that's what this whole trial is really about. It's a mental health and a psychotic break. And if you can't imagine this woman doing it because of what you're seeing in the courtroom, because of the testimony you're seeing, you have to find the monster somewhere. And so who deviates from the norm of what we visually see in that courtroom? We see Patrick with very little affect, very, very detail-oriented, very much in knowing of what's going on. He's got depth of field of his ex-wife, the medications and everything going on. And so when we as a mass see all these people in her circle so close like this, and then we see someone who got married 3 years after, moved to Manhattan, stand by her side. And in other words, our brain wants to find the villain in this. Since we're no longer willing to put the villainous on her, we're going to put it on someone rather than an institution or the psychosis itself. And so I think that's a reason why this is happening.
It's filling in the blank, basically.
Yeah.
Our brain is searching for the blank.
Yes.
Because we're basically walking Mad Libs.
Once we get an idea of what we think it is, well, then we're going to now find facts, data, and details with our confirmation bias and our amazing skill set of finding patterns where real patterns don't really exist to support our conclusion that we've now concluded. People have said this all. I don't like the way he looks. He's not having a reaction what he should be having. He got married too fast. He must be guilty. Now we're going to start looking at facts, data, and details to support the conclusion we've come to, as well as it makes us more susceptible to the world of TikTok, social media, and all these other conjectures and thought experiments that are people twisting around, which aren't based on facts, data, and details, because they dismissed it and dismissed him because alibi, time, motive, I mean, everything was dismissed rapidly on that. Plus, if you watch Reddington for 5 minutes, do you really think anything would slip by him, or anything one would slip by any of these people? So again, the laws of probability, and you opened up with stranger things have happened. Not that often.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, it's just, I when I first heard this, I thought, well, this is really fringe. And then it's like, it's not so fringe. There's a lot of people believing this.
Sure.
And my wife brought it up to me the other day, because she's not really following this very closely, but she saw a TikTok about it, and she's like, have you heard this one? And I'm like, yeah. And I immediately am just like, it's bullshit, whatever, you know? And then she started talking about it more, and I'm like, okay, tell me more of like, what are you hearing? You know, it's as someone who's just kind of passively taking this in. And I'm trying to understand, it's not that she believes it, but it was like, what's registering here that's intriguing you? Because it's an intriguing thought, and it's pulling people in. But a lot of it, because she sent me like one of the laundry lists that are out there of here's everybody's theory, and it wasn't her list, it was somebody that came up with it. And immediately you go to it, and it's filled with mistruths or just lies or not things that are not factual. Like one of the first things I saw in there is he got remarried within 4 months. No, he didn't. It was 3 years. Mm-hmm. 3 years.
Confirmed it this past April.
Like
April 2026.
What is wrong with that? I mean, even that people are like, that's too soon.
No,
3 years is a long period of time.
And also, I mean, I looked, you know, me and my stats, you know, because I always start with stats and research, and then we see how it fits a pattern of behavior or not fits a pattern of behavior. And so, yeah, getting married within 3 years of a traumatic event like this and losing three children, it is rapid. So
it is?
It is. Actually, it is rapid, but it actually falls within a trauma response for healing. So so the affect we're typically seeing is, I did the research on this too. You know, when you hear, we only saw the text and transcription of the 911 call and what his response was from first responding when they showed up, and his massive emotional response of, she fucking killed the kids. I mean, it was, you know, you
I'd
can
probably
see,
say the same thing. And it's not like you're saying it like, fuck and so the when, kids. You're saying, she killed the fucking kid. I mean, that's not even the actual testimony. That was actually the internet that added that to it.
Right. And so what you're seeing, though, is when you see him in the courtroom, he's deviating from what we're seeing from everyone else in the emotional response. But what you're seeing him, though, is you're seeing most likely, not a licensed clinician here, you're seeing his trauma response to trying to compartmentalize the loss he's been through.
Yeah.
So you're not seeing the same. He's got roadblocks up. He's got psychological blocks up because he can't face that horror every day. Yeah. And that's also a reason why some people get married that soon after. Granted, 3 years is not a huge amount of time, but it's also not a super short amount of time either. It's on the low end of recovering from this, but the desire for him to move on and move forward is what fuels those. Again, pure conjecture, but it doesn't fall so out of the norm that people say it must be him.
Well, to me, it's like, what are we basing this on? Number one, to me, like 3 years seems like a pretty fair amount of time to have found someone that's helping you heal, because inevitably you're going to need somebody that can help you with that process for the rest of your life after going through something like that. And it's not unreasonable to think that within 3 years, you might have come across someone that may fit that bill, and that you may develop a relationship within 3 years that turns into somebody and something that you want to spend the rest of your life with. I don't, like, that does not register. 4 months, I'd be a little bit like, this is probably not healthy. You know, I don't know that you're, but everybody heals differently. There's a lot of people that have spouses that die or something traumatic happens. And it actually, you know, I'm not saying it's good, but they do move on to somebody else quickly because they fall into that, the arms of someone else, if you will, you know, and there's a trauma bond that begins and then they start, you know, healthy, sure, not healthy, you look at however you want. But 3 years seems pretty normal to me. It doesn't seem like it's out of bounds. And I just don't understand where people are coming from going, that's way too quick. Number one, who the hell out there has been in this situation? I don't think most anyone exactly like this, like nobody. I mean, it's 1 in 1,000 women that this even happens to. So to break this down to this level, your scope of people that can comparatively say, well, here's how I handled it, or here's how I would handle it, is like slim to none. And I just, even looking at it from an outsider in, I don't know, it doesn't register to me as weird.
Well, it's also the connection between Manhattan, his trip to Manhattan prior to this incident happening, and then her being Manhattan and moving. So I think it's a Manhattan connection too, which was, it again, they don't go into details, but he did not apparently meet her until after the murders of three children, but he did do a trip to Manhattan. She's a lawyer in Manhattan. So the possibility of meeting her on a trip he took at some point later. Yeah. It's just time and place, but people are screwing with the timeline of actually when they met to fit the narrative they want it to be.
That's exactly what's happening. Like, he went to Manhattan before, so he must have had, or he was doing business in Manhattan because he's living in Massachusetts.
But the whole thing that undermines that as well is when you look at the arc of their because again, I when these things pop up, I deep dive them. I never ever dismiss any theories that come out there because you never know. Like you said, stranger things have happened. But when you do the deep dive, and the deep dive I always do is relationships. I do healthy relationships. I'm looking for the healthy signs of relationships. I'm looking for periods of gaps of time where there can be a lack of transparency. I'm looking for the transparency between these two. I'm looking for depth of field they had in each other's lives. I'm looking at what the people around them are saying about the relationship, what they're saying about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because inevitably, in every case we've covered, in every life I follow in life, if there's an issue, there's going to be a leak, there's going to be a wobble, and those things are those little puffs of smoke that might be fire or red flag that goes up, and then you do a deep dive. So far, I have not seen, and we have not been privy to, any red flags at all between the relationship, as reported by the people in her life, Lindsay's good friends, both sets of parents, as well as the daycare provider for the kids that came in. She testified. I mean, it's just non-existent.
Well, the biggest elephant in the room on this theory, I mean, I can break down. I mean, the timeline doesn't make any sense as to what they're saying, like how he would have staged this. It just doesn't add up. Like, so the conspiracy,
it's a lot of work.
I'm not even going to entertain it or try to break it because it just doesn't work. The conspiracy timeline is bullshit. It doesn't work. But the biggest elephant in the room to me is just the fact that Lindsay Clancy, it would still be covering for him to this day in that courtroom has convinced an attorney as well to cover for him. And this just doesn't work in any way, shape, or form to make sense.
Or that he must have been a pharmaceutical mastermind in order to blank her mind out. In other words, he had the Men in Black pen to blank her mind out.
And the toxicology, a psychotic state is different than being over-medicated or toxicity of medication.
Or not remembering.
And she wasn't in a toxic state of medication. That's not to say the medications weren't working well or interacting incorrectly. You don't have to overdose on the medication. There's so much misunderstanding in this case of what these things even mean. Mm-hmm. People think that, well, the medication wasn't working, that she was overdosing, she wasn't taking it, or she wasn't taking enough of it. It's just like, people, drugs interact differently, and SSRIs and all these different types of meds that she was on, antipsychotics, benzodiazepines, you name it, they interact differently. There's half-lives. You get on it. It takes time to get on for it to even work, and then to get off, even if it's not working. The way she was going on and off of 30 of these now in the course of 4 months is the most current crazy number. That no one should be prescribing that, no matter what. There's no human being on this planet that should be going on and off of 30 of these medications in 4 months, or what the more condensed version is, 13 in like 3 weeks or something.
And as you listen to the psychiatrist Tufts this morning on Cross from Reddington, again, as of the recording of this, her depth of field and knowledge of the impact of what these medications on Lindsay would have been is actually minimal. She had only been a fully licensed on her own psychiatrist for 1 month prior to taking Lindsay as a client. And she had been in residency for a couple years. But this is what Reddington really was hammering on, is she had been a fully licensed, able to medicate without the supervision of another physician for 1 month prior to taking on Lindsay as a client, and had only roughly a small number of people as a fully licensed. Granted, she said she saw about 40 or 50 people with postpartum depression during her time of being a resident, but never ever had handled anyone with psychotic break. And also Reddington also highlighted, I can't remember the name of the assessment, we'll have to definitely ask
Siobhan,
because she's been covering everything so closely on this. She didn't even provide one of the postpartum assessments that is a standard that a lot of doctors give, a lot of psychiatrists give. Her depth of field, and the big thing was, and I know we're talking about the husband on this one, but she had never seen Lindsay she met Patrick once. This is the psychiatrist Tufts, and she had never met Lindsay in person until court. Everything was teleconference. Everything. She stated she was primarily there as a psychiatrist for the medication issues that she had to deal with, and she provided up to 9 to 15 minutes tops of counseling during these sessions that she actually had Lindsay in. And when pressed by Reddington, what kind of therapy did you provide? Well, I validated her. I said there's hope. I made her feel better. And he says, exactly how? And she couldn't answer. So it was really highlighting that issue. So when you see the wobbles in the care she was given clinically, it really, that on top of the fact that timelines don't light up on Patrick, kind of doing my full circle back here, it's just kind of ludicrous. You can see very evident. And that's why I've really encouraged people to watch, the clips.
Yeah.
They're covering it very, very well on Court TV and other places as well. You can just do it by section if you just want to watch, one of these people under testimony. It's been very interesting and very good, very educational.
We've been putting up the audio of the testimony every single day on on the podcast. So if you want to get that, go to wherever you get podcasts and search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you will find the podcast audio. It's maddening. It really is
predictable. Maddening. Well, it happens every time. It does. Unfortunately, I think it just says more about the people that do that and then propagate misinformation without that, and that's not our audience, which is really great, because on here we focus on critical thinking. We entertain all thoughts, we live in the world of maybe, and then we explore everything by let's look at facts, data, detail, probabilities, and then relationships involved, see life arcs, we see behavior arcs, we assess everyone involved with each other, and we come up with very reasonable, pragmatic, easy conclusions, because everything dealing with every single case really does boil down to horrendous things don't get all that complicated when you really boil it down to the grassroots of what happened. Because the more complex you make something, or a hypothesis you make it, or a conspiracy theory, the more complex it is, the less likely it is to have happened. Because people can't keep their mouths shut.
It's a lot of hoops to jump through on this one to make that one work.
It is.
But your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube, I welcome it. Let's talk about more of the case itself. 8 days of a testimony, actually 9 now in the Lindsey Clancy trial. Something strange keeps happening. The prosecution's own witnesses keep describing a wonderful mother, her friends, her nanny, Patrick's own father. Then a medical examiner walked the jury through what happened to 8-month-old Callan, and Lindsey sobbed so hard the judge had to stop the trial. You guys have a lot of questions about this, a lot of statements coming up over and over, and we're going to try and get to a lot of your questions in this case, in this segment, and our next, we're going to talk about Nancy Guthrie a little bit too, so that's coming up, so hang out for that. And of course, drop your questions in the comments section as we now kind of move on to the actual trial itself, not the conspiracy that somehow naturally, everything seems to have come along with a conspiracy these days.
Die out.
It's true, though. It feels like every case we cover now is a conspiracy. It just used to be some cases we get a conspiracy. Now it seems like everyone.
Well, you know why? The algorithms feed it.
Yeah.
That's why they do. People come up with it really to invent it so they can get hits, likes, subscribes, and everything else. You know, so if you're a nutter, you get more likes and you make more money. I mean, it really, the Google machine supports nutters.
That's true. It does. I mean, if you can come up with a crazy idea on a case, you're going to get people looking at it. Yeah. She Googled the takeout, sent her husband on the errand, and had exactly enough time. This is a comment. I want to believe she was sick, but that looks like a plan to me. Somebody talk me out of it. Okay. Talk her out of it, Robin.
Science is solid. I looked it up again, and Siobhan can speak to it better because she's licensed in this area, but a psychotic break, you can actually do that volume and that amount of pre-planning and still be in a psychotic break. Because when you hear the word psychotic break or psychosis, we're really thinking that it's a brain on, brain off. It's a different, I think people kind of naturally, their brains go to kind of like schizophrenia. They become someone else.
Yeah.
That's not the way it works. And it ebbs and as I understand it ebbs and flows out of how aggressive it is or how it recedes. And when you're in it, you can be in it for minutes, hours, days, or weeks. And it's something added on top. So she was having command hallucinations is part of what she's saying she had, which is part of psychosis, part of this. These command hallucinations, and I looked this up because the real legal battle here is, should she have been reasonably able to make a choice to overcome command hallucinations in the psychotic break? Because that is really what is at stake here, and this is what the real trial is about. Is the choice and understanding of what she was doing was wrong, and she had a choice to not do it. And so that's why they're examining these command hallucinations. And so these command hallucinations are added on top of everyday life, so it cannot, for others outside looking in, it does not look like she's in psychosis. Matter of fact, that's why the psychiatrist said she did not present as being in psychosis, even though internally she was in psychosis. And this is what the next group of people on the stand are going to show, and also as described by her and all the people in her life, because the only thing that would explain the behavior that she had of killing her 3 kids with all these people saying what a great wife, mother, not overwhelmed, not trying to get out of being a mother, all these things, the only thing that would explain that would be a psychotic event. And mm-hmm. So that's why you can do planning while still in a psychosis doing these horrendous things. And the compulsion that someone feels And the fear they have of not doing what the command voice says is that it's that overwhelming, that prevalent, that it's unless you've ever experienced one yourself or witnessed one in person, I think it's very, and that's why people have a challenge with this one. It's very, very hard to understand exactly how powerful that is and why it actually is a reason for the insanity plea.
I've been trying to think of a way to try and make an analogy or to understand this better. Bear with me. I'm going to give it a shot here. I'm just kind of coming up with this on the fly. It's a horrendous, obviously, thing that she did. She admits to doing it. And on the outside looking in reality, it obvious horrific. As horrible as it can get. There's not a world where a healthy brain's going to look at that and be like, oh, this is normal. This is just another thing. This is as mundane as it's raining outside. Let me get the umbrella out. You don't think anything of getting an umbrella out when it's raining because it's raining. To be in a psychotic state almost, I've never been in one, but this is how I would try to understand it. If it's a sunny day and your brain is telling you it's pouring out, everyone else around you knows it's a sunny day, but your brain, it's stuck on saying it's raining. So no matter what anyone says to you, you're going to take your umbrella because that's just what you do. That's your expectation here. When she's in this state, horrendous, this idea of killing the kids and taking them to God because it's her last chance. That act in her mind is not horrendous. That act is not, oh my God, this is horror. It's about as eventful as taking an umbrella out and going into the rain. It's what you do. It doesn't make any sense. It's not based in reality. It's not even based on anything of any sense whatsoever. But her brain is firing in a way that is just as fucking normal as it is to take an umbrella out when it's raining. And I think that's what's hard for people to understand because we're all going, oh my God, you're going to do this to your children with these exercise bands? And she's just like, put the umbrella up and go outside. It's just that simple. There's no extra thought to it. There's not contemplation. There's not, oh my God, I'm killing my children. It's an action. It's what you do because the voices are telling you. And that's the scary thing of the psychosis and being in that sort of a state is crazy, horrible things seem like just another Tuesday to you. And that's how people are able to carry them out so easily and readily because there's not the safeguard. There's not that emotion or that pause in your brain saying, this is wrong, this is bad. And that's what's being litigated. Was there anything telling her, this is wrong, this is bad? And they're saying, no, in a state of psychosis like this, because there's a difference between being psychotic and being in a state of psychosis.
Yeah, as well as mental health issues,
yes,
too, because mental health is not an excuse. That's why Nick Reiner most likely is not going to be able to claim mental health as a defense.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have firsthand experience with a few people in my life with things I've done. With the only thing I can come close to is withdrawal symptoms from like alcohol or drug abuse.
Yeah.
I have known people, very, very sane, good people that were completely sober, only I think like 24, 48 hours when this happens, when the auditory hallucination starts. And so here's someone completely sane, completely sober, that's having hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, where, no kidding, they heard music and walls, completely sane, having a conversation with me, taking a sledgehammer that I got to take out of the hands because they wanted to break down the wall, even though they said, I know it can't be there, but I got to turn this goddamn music off. And they break in trying to break down walls because they heard music coming from a wall.
That's what? How real it is. Yeah.
And they knew it, but they couldn't stop it. Even though they weren't even on anything anymore. That was just the residual effect of hallucination, of an auditory hallucination, and something at the level that Lindsay was going on. It's like a full psychosis. That was way above and beyond. And so, and that's why it is the only thing, and it's so rare. I think the last case I saw where it actually was claimed as a defense and worked, I think it was the 80s. And so, because again, it's 1 in 1,000 women suffer from this, and even less do something horrendous against their kids for this. And that's why it is that rare. That's why it strikes us such a chord with us. That's why people come up with conspiracy theories, because when you actually see her life arc and everyone in her life saying it couldn't have been her, I mean, just think about this. If she had not admitted that she was the one that killed these kids, we'd be looking for another killer right now, because no one in their right mind would believe she did it.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think you would have had a lot of people. I mean, obviously the evidence is there. I mean, that's nearly impossible to dispute. But you're right. I mean, the fact that she flat out said, yeah, it was me.
I mean, yeah. I know there's a lot of other evidence, but if you remove maybe the method, time, place, you know, so there's not the data and the evidence for it, and you remove her confession of it, because of who she is and how she's lived and all the testimony and everything, you would be looking for someone else. People would be looking much harder at Patrick or anyone else in that family and life, because I mean, I would, my first response would be not her.
Yeah.
Because all these things, very much like, and I know it'll flame a lot of people, very much like Richard Allen.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very clear case of what psychosis truly is.
It really is. It's the best
because it does go from one extreme to another very fast. And in a lot of other cases that this keeps getting compared to inaccurately, you see a buildup and you see premeditation. You see someone who's planning something. This was not that. And even if this was, I mean...
And she did. I mean, she did a little. She did some research here and there,
yeah.
Moments before, or maybe, so give her grace.
Yeah.
You know, say, all right, so she planned it for a day or two. Okay, that's still within the realm of a psychotic break. I mean, it's well within it.
And when you're in that mindset, it's like when you think it's raining out, you're going to do preparations for the raining. In the raining in her mind was a voice saying that you only got so much time to take the kids out. Doesn't make any sense, but you're going to do preparation for that, because in your brain, that's just another Tuesday. It's all on track. And that's what's so scary, because when you can pop out of that, you're like, what the hell was I thinking? And that's, I'm sure, what she's feeling in that courtroom of like, how did my brain betray me in such a way? And whether that was because of going on and off of all these medications in such a short period of time, I'm going to guess that played a role. But yeah. The thing is, with this case, even more so, anybody who's arguing the medications issue, take the meds out of it. Her brain was fully capable of doing this madness all by itself.
Yeah. Yep.
The meds just exacerbated the problem more than anything else. That leads us to the next question, another comment that we see quite often. Here's what it says verbatim. The prosecutors held up 9 pill bottles full of pills. This is being all dramatic in court. So which is it? And this is what they want people to believe, that's so black and white. She was over-medicated or she wasn't even taking them. Those both can't be the story. No, but they can. They can very much both be the story. Because when you go on, when a doctor is prescribing meds, and we're seeing how the doctors prescribe them, mm-hmm. very ad hoc is pretty much how it was, meaning at will. Most of these meds, there is, if you're going on them in a healthy function, it's normally, okay, this may take 2 to 3 months to really kick in. What was going on here is she was on them for a short period. The doctor, she's saying, this isn't working. And rather than being like, it's going to take more time, they're like, oh, let me give you a different one. Let me give you another one. Let me do this one. And one's not communicating with the other. And you can't mix some of these things the way they were being mixed, because that can lead your brain to go crazy, which is exactly what happened. Surprise. And people are having a hard time understanding this, and I guess bless their hearts, because they've never dealt with medication like this on a personal level for themselves or anyone close to them. Consider yourself lucky. But if you have, you'd understand how those things work. And the repercussions of it aren't just you had too much or too little. It's the interactions of them. Mm-hmm. And you're relying on the professionals to medicate you. But she was a labor and delivery nurse. Yeah, she wasn't a prescriber of psychiatric medication.
Oh, yeah, big difference.
So I don't care that argument. She's going to a professional, and the professionals are failing her. Being a labor and delivery nurse doesn't excuse the problem. and they're failing her and she's relying on them. And then this happened, but we still want to blame her. I don't get it. I do not understand why there is this strong desire to not understand what's happening here. It's not even this strong desire to go after her. It's like a willingness to ignore facts, to ignore reality, and ignore even trying to understand mental health and how these medications work. I don't know why. Is it because it's too scary? And it's too icky to think that people are capable of this sort of shit, or that the drugs that we readily take that our safe doctors prescribe to us, that are advertised during our favorite television shows, could actually end in ways like this. So we just kind of keep that over there and pretend that that's not anything. It's just bad witch lady over here. It's Massachusetts, after all. We're good at burning witches there. I mean, this really kind of feels like that at the end of the day. This feels like a modern day witch trial. We're basically saying, medicine doesn't matter. Mental health is not a thing. She's evil. Burn her. And all the evidence to the contrary is over here, but we're just not even going to take that in. This is a modern day witch trial. Like, yeah, in every sense of the imagination, every sense of the word.
It's a hard thing, I think, because this, again, because a psychotic break and psychosis, postpartum psychosis, is so rare and unusual, we don't have a frame of reference to really grasp our minds around it. And so we want to keep pointing the fingers everywhere else. And also, the fear is our greatest motivator. And when we fear our government organizations and institutions fall down, we get fearful. We want a place to blame. We want to do other things. I mean, most of the time, Tony, what we cover is the failure of our government institutions when it comes to law enforcement, the legal system. I mean, a lot of times those things fail us because they're imperfect. But never, ever have we really gone at a mental health system to this degree. I mean, it always pops up on these cases because mental health is always in the background noise of all these cases because no healthy people do horrendous things, right? And so what we're seeing here, though, exposed, again, watch testimony. When you saw the psychiatrist Tufts up on a stand and you see someone who is fresh out of residency, 1 month out, taking a case like this on, and you see her lack of depth of field. Again, this is not it's a hit on her, but it's a hit on the whole institution, the whole in other words, think in the terms of how desperate is our mental health system that you're going to hire her and put her lead on such a big case. Inside the FBI, my relation on this was my squad of 12 people or 10, 12 people in New York City, and got assigned to work counterintelligence in New York City. Our main purpose, our main objective is to recruit intelligence officers working on behalf of the Russian government. In order to be given the highest priority case, like the most critical one, which could impact lives, nation states, you think they're going to give it to the guy that just turned 29 years old, spent, you know, a year in training, 5 years in the Marine Corps? No, they give me the case low below that. And then if I have some reps and I show that I can handle some lower cases and get some more experience without an umbrella of a residency under me, then they'll give me a bigger one to be mentored, taught, and guided, or at least someone to bounce the ideas off of. But again, who knows what's going on? But the way that Reddington is exposing the system, and she is just a product of that system being Tufts, is that she was hired and thrown out to the wolves. She had no idea what the marketing was about. They promoted her as an expert at postpartum depression with females. Mm-hmm. And she had no idea about that. She has no idea that how the system, the intake system works and what forms are filling out online. Yeah. And I mean, there was so many gaps.
It's like everybody's got to start somewhere. I get that. And unfortunately, I don't think, and I'm not trying to make it an indictment on her. I mean, I think there was a lot of
system.
Yeah, a lot of missteps here, without a doubt. I can't imagine, like, you're new to the, this is your first, you know, year or two in practice, and then you get this, like, this would be enough to make you go, that was fun. I'm going to do something else. The system, this is indicative. This is norm.
I'm sorry.
Normal in the system, unfortunately. This is not abnormal. Most med checks are about 17 minutes, quite honestly.
Yeah, and she kept using a term that I think goes to the point of what we're saying with medications and the snip, snap, on and off. She kept saying, when he said, what was the dosage that you went by? Why did you choose this medication for her? And her answer always was, well, it's a general consensus. You start with this.
Yep. And that's how it works.
And so you start with what, and he said, well, who says it's the general consensus? And she couldn't answer any science, data, research. She says, just general consensus among psychiatrists that you start with this.
And it's based on the psychiatrist you're talking to and what their understanding is of the condition and what they think is going to work best. And you can go from one psychiatrist to the next, and one may go, why are you on that? And well, because so-and-so told me, gave me this huge story as to why I should be on it. Or maybe they didn't say anything at all. Maybe they were just like, I think we're going to put you on this one. It's just great. It works really good. And either way, you're the patient. You're going to take their expertise at face value because you're trusting that they're looking out for your best interests and your health. That's why you're there, and that's their job. So you're relying on that. And then the next professional you're talking to could completely contradict that story. Like, no, I don't think that's the right one for you. We should put you on this one. And this is how it works. This is how it happens. I've been there. I've seen it. I've seen it with people I've been with. I've seen it myself when I've gone on, when I was on some things a while ago. And it's fucking insane. I mean, it's really insane the way that it works, because there's a lot of conjecture involved, and there isn't and it's true. This is not a one size fits all by any means. We're talking about mental health or any of these drugs, but the cattle calls that are med checks or going and getting meds from certain providers sometimes are really disturbing in terms of how quickly they will move you in and move you out with just a few questions. And just thinking, if you just asked a few more questions, you might get to a little deeper of an understanding of the person's condition, and you could probably make a better decision. But it's get them in, get them out, get them prescribed, and get that money from the insurance company, from so many of these providers. And I'm not saying that's what they were doing at this office, but I'm saying that is how the system works. And this is unfortunately not super abnormal for the way this system works. And that's the reality that I don't think the country wants to hear either.
And I can see telehealth working more effectively if you're dealing with like a sore throat, a headache, you know, an upset stomach or something. But when you're dealing with psychiatry, that's a problem, because Reddington highlighted this. He highlighted the behaviors that she most likely could have missed as a psychiatrist, only doing telehealth with someone in psychosis or at least dealing with postpartum depression. He said, well, if you're just seeing her from the waist up, did you know what she was doing with her hands? Could you note any stress indicators? Could you know any pacifying behaviors that she was exhibiting even as you're asking her questions? Could you take in all that data as you're making your assessment? No, you can't.
No.
And to be prescribing the level of medication she was, again, as she's feeling out, again, she was following, I believe she's following a protocol, because that's what doctors do. You're following an algorithm for diagnoses, and when you're not cross-referencing, because you're dealing with a lot of pharmaceuticals that are coming in and out of the system, and I think they, you know, to Lindsay's benefit, into her detriment at the same time, because someone highlighted while she was a nurse. And absolutely, I think part of what she was doing very well, I think, was her level of transparency and lack of shame of sharing with people was huge, because she knew in order to get treated, she needed to be transparent, because she's a nurse. She understands that in order for accurate assessment, she needs that. So she was being completely transparent. And so I think people took for granted that, because if you didn't say she's in psychosis, and you, because her psychiatrist did not believe she's in psychosis, then you're going to believe all the words she's saying.
But, and surprise, no one ever says they're in psychosis.
Right.
Like, it's like, hey, by the way, I'm in active psychosis right now. Hey, what do you think I should tell? Like, that's not
and
how
she even said that. There, she gave the outward signs that is that can be presented if someone's in psychosis. And Lindsay wasn't having any of those signs. But then she also talked about the internal things that are going on inside the brain that would indicate psychosis. And the only way for a psychiatrist to know those is if the patient shares those things or is aware of those things going on. And I think only someone with much more experience to look at wobbles from what they'd expect from someone healthy or just going through a more 1 in 10 probability of a just postpartum depression, because she was prescribing for depression, even though the prescription the the depression subscription was going to exasperate, even said on the side effects, going to exasperate her insomnia, which is also a fuel of kerosene on the fire of the psychosis. I mean, it's just one big mess.
Which a lot of times people in these states, one of their, I can't speak for Lindsay Clancy, I've seen it, but one of the biggest fears I know with this, when you're in these sort of states, is sleep, because these medications do not help you with that. And fear of not getting enough sleep. I mean, just take all the shit out of it. Take all the postpartum, everything out of it. If you're not getting enough sleep and you're a healthy person, you're not going to be operating on all cylinders. So you already know you're not operating on all cylinders. You already have anxiety. You already got this shit going on. And all these medications are messing with you on top of your own body doing the hormones. And you're fearing that you're not getting enough sleep because your body's already not working right. And these medications mess with that as well. Add that shit show on top of everything. It's a hellish place to live for a lot of these women. And a lot of people have no clue just how horrific life is when they're in these sort of states, and how hopeless and damn near impossible it feels like to get out of, and how frustrating it must be when provider after provider is not giving you the adequate attention you need to get to a solution for where you're at. And sometimes it does take time, but it's not like Lindsay didn't give it a chance by any means.
And one more thing on the sleep deprivation thing. Sorry, Tony. This one, actually, I do have firsthand experience with. So we talked about the things you can have an auditory hallucination from psychosis, from the experience of someone just going through withdrawals, right? Well, when I was going through the Marine Corps, I was going through training at Quantico. And one of the things they do during officer training at the basic school in Quantico is they expose you to sleep deprivation during what we had when I went through called the 9-day war. And this sleep deprivation, I think I was awake nonstop for either 36 or 50 hours. See, I don't even remember accurately, because what happens, they want you to experience what your brain will do under sleep deprivation. And I can tell you what, when I hit, I think, the 50-hour point where it's at nighttime and we're in what's called a blocking position. We actually had our foxholes, and it was February here in Quantico, just north of me in Virginia, where I live. I was cold as hell, and I'm sitting next to someone next to me. We're all been awake the same amount of time. And I shit you not, he looks at me and goes, "Did you see that?" And I go, "Yeah, I did. We started seeing things in the woods. We started hearing things that weren't there. We saw people, images, and noises in the woods in front of us." And it was all sleep deprived and induced. Yeah. It had nothing to do with anything else. It was that massive sleep. So again, when we're talking about someone who actually, and I believe it'll come out, because I think I've read this somewhere, again, my conjecture from what I believe I read, she actually has a genetic, because psychoses can be inherited, it can be genetic. And I think there is a history of that genetic in her family, potentially. Again, I know it'll come out in the trial if it is. But regardless, she has a psychosis. And then all these things, both the medications as well as sleep deprivation, all these things are more and more kerosene on the fire. Going to your original thing you said earlier, Tony, was that I think the probability of this happening or her being a psychosis was most likely inevitable. And all the mismanagement of medication exasperated to this deadly conclusion that happened.
We're going to talk more about the difference between being psychotic and psychosis on Wednesday with Siobhan.
Thank goodness.
And we're going to go deeper into this conversation on the mental health side. So I want you to join us Wednesday, 11 Central, here for that live. And if you want, you can certainly catch it on the repeat. But we're going to dive into that much deeper. There's just so much to this case. And it really requires understanding. This is not one to be flippant about, because it is very important to understand if we're ever going to do better at this. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Let's touch on one more case that obviously people are still talking about. We're still talking about.
Yeah.
We are still lots of comments about Nancy Guthrie. 84 years old. She'd just come home from dinner with her family, and by morning, she was gone. Blood on her porch, her doorbell camera dead, her pacemaker disconnected at 2:28 in the morning. For 6 months now, the people investigating this held two letters that claimed to explain everything, including one that says she'd already been dead and buried somewhere in nature. On July 31st, they finally let the public read them, and the question filling up our inboxes now ever since is the one no family should ever have to ask. Do you believe the note? And I guess the big question is, should the family believe it? The second note says she perished shortly after she was taken, that she's buried in nature now. If that were my mom, this is a comment we got from somebody. If that were my mom, I don't know if I could accept a letter as an answer. Should the Guthries believe a word of it? Well, that's a good question. Should they believe a word of these two notes? And I want to just conjecture it here too, why the two are connected. Because there's been a lot of notes that have come in. TMZ's talked about all different ones. The only reason these two have any sort of weight is they came in early, they were from the same IP address, and they appear in that first one to mention things that some believe would be unknowable unless you were actually there, saying that the floodlight was destroyed, which we still have yet to confirm if the damn thing was actually destroyed. People just seem to take that at face value. I talked to Koff about it the other day. I'm like, was it destroyed? Do we even know if that was destroyed? And nobody seems to know for sure. Or if it was just burned out. Destroyed and burned out are a little different. And that the watch was found on the floor. And that was noted, and that it was specific enough that, of course, someone would have to have been in the house to know it. I don't know. I think that's up for a little bit of conjecture, too. Robin, what do you think? Should the family believe that these notes have anything to do with the actual disappearance of their mother?
So, these notes, I think, are really, really good for investigators. They're good for us to understand what happened. It helps us remove all these wild conspiracy theories or really complicated explanations. So let's look at, really, we have two possibilities here that we're really left with that people seem to be locking in on. There's no other notes anyone's given any attention to. So we either have these two notes, like you said, they came from the same IP, so most likely from the same person, or they're fakes. So let's go down both avenues. So I'm edging towards they actually are from someone, from the porch guy that went in this house. I'm edging on that side. So okay. I'll give it a 60% on this one. But as always, maybe. And here's why. So if they are, my theory, now a good friend of mine, Dr. Chris Mahandy, he agrees, as well as other FBI profilers, retired Jim Clemente and others, not all, but some, agree that it looks like home invasion for something of value in the house that went sideways, panic escalation, she and Nancy is removed from the home. So why do the notes support that? Because these notes, the first one in particular, does not fit any other standard or even expected or methodology as a primary, as in other words, plan A for abduction. It was plan B for abduction. And what I mean by that, even the FBI's words, or I think it's or Pima County, one or the other, they said they're treating it as if it was an abduction, not it is an abduction, as if, because right, at the end of the day, it was an abduction for ransom. It wasn't the primary. That's why I hear that language. I say as if. So for me, note A and then B, we'll get to in a second, was because plan A fell apart, could not find what they're looking for in the house. So they decided we're going to take Nancy. And then what happens, so if money is your intention to get and ransom was the way to get it, you would not have, one, you would have shown a sign of life. You would have made it easy to get the money and you would have followed through on it. Rapid succession, make it easy, in, out, gone. That is exactly how every single ransom goes, whether it's a novice or whether experienced with the cartel. I don't care what it is. It's never, ever been recorded this way. So laws of probability is zero. The second note then, let's take it as it's real, because this is the theory we're on right now. They completely gave up on the money. What? So they're mitigating the fact that, as everyone has said, including our good friend Jen Coffendeffer, that they're mitigating in case they're caught because of that. And it's also extremely empathetic. Empathetic people don't take bodies for one thing, and don't take people for ransom. It's more pragmatic than that. And also, they gave up on the money. Well, what would compel someone, if that was their primary objective, was to use Nancy for financial gain? why not still double down and get financial gain from returning Nancy? Because they didn't have a plan for it. It was plan B. So plan A was getting something at a house, and it fell through, so they had to go to plan B. Those notes to me are so solidly saying that her ransom abduction was plan B. And then some people will say, well, note B, it was just to torment. There is zero language in there or leakage anywhere else saying that these notes were meant for torment, they're meant for giving agonizing or anything like that to the family. It was literally, we want out, we're done, we're not giving asking for any money, and we're running away, and we're mitigating our impact by saying this. Now, that is if we believe the notes are real. Now, let's go down the road if the notes aren't real. Well, you know what happens then? Nancy's missing. And no ransom. So it's either she was taken as ransom and it was plan B, yeah, as according to the notes, or she was taken.
Do you think...
That's it.
Do you think she was already dead when the first note came out? Where it goes, and if we don't get it by this time, the price goes up. And if we don't get it by then, she's dead. Well, they end up sending that second note from the same IP before the deadline of the price increase in saying that she's already dead. That's what's weird to me about the whole thing. Was it an initial like, oh, shit, she's already dead. Let's try and get some money out of this. And it doesn't work. I'm wondering if there was some intervention in the meantime there, because it almost sounds like they're written by two different people, or somebody got to that person that thought, well, let's try and get some money. And this is, I think, how ransom letters work. And it doesn't work out. And they go, well, if we get caught, it's almost like they're mitigating their, you know, the circumstance here of the damage that they're doing. If we show some remorse, it was an accident, it was horrible, we have evidence of that on the record, because they're so fearful that they're going to get caught. That second letter just feels like it was a kid that knows, you know, the teacher's going to come. They're going to at some point figure out that, you know, the cookies are missing off the desk, and they're going to look at the camera and figure out who took them. So they're going to, I wasn't even hungry, you know, whatever, just some sort of shit. You know, I was going to feed the starving child down the road, whatever, some sort of reason that's going to not make it as bad as it otherwise would be, is how that kind of reads. But again, it's so bizarre in general for any of it to even be out there with no body, with no other evidence. I don't know. I just, again, at the end of the day, what do we know? She was taken.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this.
Everything beyond that is still a big, giant question mark.
You know, as some folks had said, including Jen, it looks as if that blood splatter on the front porch came from like a bloody nose dripping from being over someone's shoulder. My thought process on this, the way the notes are written from my point of view, is that she was taken and most likely not coherent or unconscious or barely conscious when they took her. She's probably having an episode as they left. And so I think when they got her to the location, sent the first note out, she might not have even been conscious. And then she probably died in their care, not understanding what the hell was going on. And that's when they freaked out. So I think she was on her way out when they took her out of that house because of the shock of it, because of the impact of whatever happened in that house, which is what I'm going to tell. Although there was no blood found in the house. So I'd imagine, I mean, can you imagine someone, I mean, my parents are this age, you know, and they are extremely frail. I mean, if someone came into my parents' house, yeah, they'd probably both die, you know, on the spot, you know, some stranger like that. So kind of having the shock of that happen, passing out and falling down, or maybe she was shoved down and couldn't get back up. I mean, there's a lot of things when you're 82, 84 years old that are going to make it so you cannot come out under your own power. So I do not think she came out of that house under her own power because of the way the blood was on the front porch. And because of that first note, they're planning on that plan B. And I think plan B went right out the window, and their plan C was run fast and stay low. And because again, they either those notes are real, which indicates plan B, or they're not real, which means she was just taken by someone for no purpose or reason.
Who do you think would be more coherent and competent? Nancy Guthrie after a frying pan to the head being pulled out of her house? Or Sheriff Nanos on a Tuesday saying things like,
to toss
I don't have any note indicating she's dead, one day before his own department releases exactly that note? I'm going to go with Nancy. I think Nancy could probably deliver a more coherent, competent statement than Nanos after, while coughing up blood being drug out of her home, than Nanos on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
This is the next question. I'm not trying to be funny, but I mean, it's darkly comical in a way of just how fucking bad Nanos is. Literally saying to CBS, I don't have any note indicating that she's dead a day before the department releases that exact note saying that she's dead. This isn't like, this is the biggest damn case in the country probably right now that's active in terms of attention.
Right.
You're the sheriff that has a microscope on you now for 6 months. We're well over the hump of your words matter. I know that was like a big thing at the beginning that he had to say aloud that I'm not used to people listening to me.
There's a reason. That's a clue right unto itself, isn't it?
What the hell is going on in this man's mind, Robin? It's all conjecture here, but I mean, I'm not aware of any note. Like, are you just playing stupid, not knowing you're going to be releasing this stuff tomorrow? Or are you just really that unaware of the elements of the investigation as to which is going on right now?
I think all of it. You know, it's his... And we see this in every case. I mean, there hasn't been a case we've ever covered or I've ever researched, because I did this when we were starting to cover Nanos. I said, you know, when you do the research, is there ever someone that's the front man, the sheriff, the chief, or, you know, the colonel in charge of state police, whatever it is, has there ever been a front man or woman out in front on the first day something major like this breaks that everyone says, that was a great job? No, they all stumble. They all fall down because you never know what the impact of your words is going to be. But a vast majority of these people, after the first stumble, shut up, regroup, get better, and they move forward from there. You know, and so it's the first initial stumble, whether it's, you know, I mean, just look at a Nolan Wells case. You know, the sheriff came out with stupid statement day one saying that it was not, you know, they don't suspect foul play. Way before he should have said that. And so what's he doing now? I haven't heard from him. Good. You know, so they're just conducting an investigation. So he learned, move on. Same thing with Koberger's case. You know, the district attorney for that case, the prosecutor, he was horrendous. He was the one saying really, really dumb stuff. And so what they do, they shut him up and things got better. You know, but Nanos is not doing that. So here's my big concern with this, though. At some point, again, the law of averages on this is that we're still in a window that someone can be caught from this. And I know it's one of our questions coming up as well. But my concern with Nanos on this is I'm praying he is not indicative of how the investigation behind the scenes is being conducted. Because if it is, guys like Bob Mata are going to tear it apart. You know, because, you know, chain of custody, evidence, subpoenas, all the things you need to do to prosecute someone behind the scenes, if it's as reckless and as handled so as poorly as Nanos, if it filtered down to the investigators running this, we're screwed on justice. Because if they're not doing the investigation properly, and he's indicative of how it's being done, there's a big problem. Now, that's not always the case. A lot of times, thankfully, it's not the case. But hopefully they're doing the investigation well behind the scenes, so if they actually do eventually get someone, it actually can be prosecuted and justice will be served for the Guthrie family. But I'm
let me riddle you this one here for a second before we wrap up. Obviously, everybody does things based on their own motivations. You know, as a sheriff, you should be wanting to solve crime. I'm not saying this is his motivation here at all. Either way, I'm just in theory. What sort of motivation do you have to get this thing solved if you know at the end of the day it's just going to completely eviscerate your investigation and going to expose just how utterly incompetent you were from day one to the general public, probably to the point where you're going to get like ousted because of that incompetence on a fucking global scale in terms of publicity? What incentive do you have to solve this murder when you've already fucked up the investigation this much?
That's a good question.
Other than it's the right thing for the families. But if your motive is clearly yourself, which I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Nano seems to be one big steaming pile of narcissism, in my opinion. Those folks are going to do things that are going to benefit themselves, and they're going to avoid, like the fucking plague, anything that's going to put them in a bad light. I mean, he's already put himself in a bad light by his own words, but because it came out of his mouth, he doesn't think his shit smells. This would be different. This would be out there for the world to investigate if we got to that stage, if we found someone, if there was a trial, if when there was an investigation that could dissect the shit out of this department and really expose just all of the holes in it. There is zero incentive for him to solve this damn thing, and I'm wondering if that's what's running the real show, his ego and not wanting exposure. Crazy conspiracy on my part, not saying that's what he's doing, but I'm saying maybe that's what he's doing.
You could definitely see a world in which keeping it alive benefits him more from finding out how much he failed because the motivation to keep it alive is that if he leaves office and the case is still alive and the next guy comes along or woman comes along and they solve it and it's a mess, it's a shit show and it doesn't get prosecuted or the guy gets off, he can say, see, it wasn't me.
It's a lot of cases that don't get prosecuted correctly or don't get invested. Look at Richard Allen. That's a case that where all the systems seem to work together to block any sort of exposure to just how incompetent the departments were in any sort of fashion where they would be held accountable, because most of it never actually made it to a courtroom because the judge said, la, 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 we don't want to hear about how incompetent the police are in this department.
We did this all the time. My management. Yeah. So I think I've told the story before. Part of what I was doing with my behavior team and me as a case agent inside the bureau was I had to manage my bosses. And because it wasn't all, but some, I had some bosses that their next move in their political career inside the bureau was a promotion. And in order to get promotion, they couldn't take a risk that some, like an operation I had going was going to go sideways. And so what they would do is they would approve the operation, but not the execution. So that if the next guy came along, he could approve the execution of the operation. And if it went sideways, he could point the finger somewhere else. And so I actually had to always think in terms of two promotions in order to get an operation executed, because I need one person to approve it and the other person to execute it. That way, both fingers could point at each other if it went sideways. If I had someone in place for 12 months, which is a long time in leadership inside the bureau, means you weren't getting promoted. I had to wait 12 months before I could actually execute a lot of my operations. Not all cases, I'm not paintbrushing, but in my experience, in my circle, and serving in New York, Norfolk, Virginia, FBI headquarters, Quantico, and the Richmond division out of my Fredericksburg office here, I dealt with this a lot. People fearing to take action because they thought it was going to have negative blowback on their career. So I needed to make it part of my strategy that they could point the finger somewhere else if it went sideways. Because what am I always doing? You have to make it safe for someone to say yes to moving forward on things, and because otherwise they lived in fear. Now, that's for people who weren't considering doing the righteous work, as I say.
Yeah.
And Nanos might fall into that.
Maybe.
Don't know. Conjecture.
Yeah, it's conjecture. I don't know.
Sad but true, but that's how organizations work. And so here's a good thing for public citizen out there. The good people that know how the system and bureaucracy works know how to work with it so the work still gets done, because I was just one of many that understood the system. I didn't fight the system. I knew how to get stuff done because I knew how to take care of my bosses so they could get their promotions, because again, they were riding that balance between career and operations. Mm-hmm. And some people are leaning more one way or the other. My job is to figure out which way you're leaning so I can make you feel safe, saying yes to the righteous work so we can keep the world safe. There you go.
There's your glass half full moment of the day.
That's me. Always.
That'll wrap this up. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Be sure to check out Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever books are sold. Sheriff Nanos, this might be a good, maybe.
So many people in our lives, right?
We should send it to him. Autograph copy. All right, we're going to wrap it up right there. Your thoughts in the comments section. We'll continue with their Substack, YouTube. Links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe. Until next time, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm gonna be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for 10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.